welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast, where in every episode we explore what is research culture and what should it be. You'll hear thoughts and opinions from a range of contributors to help you change research culture into what you want it to be.
Welcome. My name is Jed Hall, and I'm the Head of Research and Development at the University of Leeds. My research and development specialism is research impact, covering the development of individuals, both researchers and research impact professionals, and organisational development related to research impact. So all of the episodes I contribute to the podcast focus on that, and they're all available via a playlist, which is in the show notes. But today is the fourth in a series of special interviews with my research impact heroes. The first was Professor Mark Reed, the second with Dr. Julie Bailey, the third was with Dr. Tamika Hayden, and a playlist with all those interviews is also available in the show notes. Now, the idea for the series is to highlight the amazing community that drives research impact around the world. And there is always that selfish aspect because it gives me an excuse to get an hour on my own with these brilliant people to talk about my passion. I'm really looking forward to today's interview because the interviewee was the first person to make me laugh out loud with an answer about research impact. That person was Dr. David Phipps, who is Assistant Vice President of Research Strategy and Impact at York University in Toronto. David, I'm really looking forward to this, and welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast.
Oh, thank you, Jed. It's very nice to be invited. Thank you so much. And my single goal is to make you laugh out loud again.
That would be lovely. You've already got me tittering. So you should be able to hit that impact goal.
Let us titter on.
Yes, indeed. Now, David, in my standard interviews, I normally put together a bit of a biographical introduction. But really, I think for these, listeners won't be downloading this episode to hear me tell them about you, the hero. So could you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in research impact, the route, however winding and meandering it was, and what motivates you about it and drives you to publish about it so much?
It shall be a winding road, that's for sure. I'm going to take you back, Jed, 40 years to my master's. I was doing my master's at Queen's University in Kingston. I was in immunology, and I joined the Kingston AIDS Project in 1986, so 40 years ago from this year. It was the mid-80s. We didn't call it knowledge mobilization. I didn't know that I was doing knowledge mobilization, but I was researching in immunology and trying to help my community, which at that time was being decimated by a disease that we were only beginning to understand. And so HIV was only isolated in 1983. I was mobilizing my knowledge about immunology to benefit my community. I didn't know that was knowledge mobilization, but I'll say that's where I started when I look back. And then my postdoctoral research was, again, in HIV research. And we discovered what might have been a rapid marker for HIV infection. And this is very important. In the mid-90s, Canada was undergoing the Creever Commission, which is a commission looking at the tainted blood supply scandal. And we needed a rapid test to reduce the period of detection from infection to detection of infection. And I was at the Canadian Blood Services, so this was a very important topic at the time, and the University of Toronto filed a patent on that. It was actually licensed to industry. It didn't work, which is why I have a job and not a private island somewhere, because that would have been yes. A very lucrative patent portfolio. Nonetheless, it was the first time that I realized that research can have a life beyond the lab, a life beyond the publication. Then I joined a research funding organization called the Canadian Arthritis Network. I left the lab and joined the Innovations Foundation, so became a tech transfer guy, university industry guy, and then I worked in the Canadian Arthritis Network, and day four on the job. I'm a university industry guy, and my job was about intellectual property and commercialization. Day four on the job, I'm presenting to a group of community doctors and arthritis specialists, and I was talking about bench to bedside. And Elizabeth Badley, wonderful, she challenged me. She said, David, most of our patients don't hit the bedside. We need to think chromosome to community, not bench to bedside. So you need to find a way for our research to be able to reach our patients in community. And so and the other experience I had was, we were a funding organization. We funded according to the research proposal, the researcher's track record, and we called this IP as another assessment criterion. We had this amazing proposal from a researcher who was looking at ways to keep people with arthritis in the workplace longer. And it scored a zero on IP. And I said, hang on, this is the opportunity to benefit people. Sure, it won't be through a patent, but this has the opportunity. We need to change IP to something else. Then I ended up working at the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. I was doing IP, but also partnerships. I authored a chapter in a report by Senator Colin Kenny on commercialization. But you know what? We started working with the International Development Research Center, Health Canada, and Foreign Affairs. We drafted language for the Africa Action Plan from the G7 meeting in Kananaskis in 2002. And then again, with Health Canada and IDRC, we developed the Canadian Coalition for Global Health Research. And so I realized that through partnering and through partnerships, there was an ability to bring research without going through commercial pathways to benefit people. And so they're all non-commercial pathways to impact. And my key takeaways are, one, research can have a life beyond the lab or the studio or the office. Research needs to partner to make a difference, and that from local to global impacts, both are important. Global impacts are not more important than local impacts. Anyway, that's what I learned there. 2003, I was hired by my current university, York University. So I've been there 23 years almost. I'm now the assistant vice president, as you've mentioned, for research strategy and impact. So York University, a bit of background, we're founded in 1959. Our roots are in social justice and liberal arts, but we're a large university now with, we've got a school of engineering, we've just launched a school of medicine, but you put a social justice guy, a university industry guy in a social justice setting. And I said, you know, we've got a little bit of engineering and we do tech transfer. We've got all of this bench strength that's relevant to public policy, to social services, and to professional practices. We do nothing to broker that. And so that was the origin of our Knowledge Mobilization Unit and then Research Impact Canada, which I know we're going to talk about later. So that's how I got to where I am. Now, the second part of your question was what motivates me? Yeah. And I think it's three things. Innovation, I saw a gap. I saw a gap at our university. We were the first university in Canada to create a knowledge mobilization unit under the vice president research. So I saw an opportunity. The second, helping others really motivates me. I've been doing this for 30 years, 40 if you include my master's work. And I'm now seeing amazing new talent enter the impact space. And you know what? You know, 10 years ago, there weren't many of us doing this work. 10, 15 years ago, now there's a lot of people doing this work. And my motivation is to help them in their careers. And the third is bringing Canada to the world. You know, Canada doesn't have a ref, and that's delightful. We'll talk more about that. But impact can thrive without a ref. And if I can bring this Canadian model to the world and help other countries realize that you don't need a ref to do impact, that there's ref impact and there's impact, non-ref. And we'll talk a bit about those. I don't need the money from a ref-like exercise to motivate me to support impact.
Yeah, that's... That's something I'm going to pick up on, because I know certainly Tamika and also Vicky Ward have really mentioned how Canada seems to have a secret sauce. So I know we've got a question about that following up. So I'll leave that hanging for you listeners in terms of piquing your interest. But yeah, it's fascinating. You know, you've kind of taken me back. You're only a little bit older than me, and it was just like fascinating. And when I first started in my job, you know, the amount of draft presentations I used to see about AIDS research. You know, it really was, certainly from medicine and health faculty, faculty researchers, it really was the big challenge at the time. And it's fantastic that that all of that work has really, you know, now you don't see as much of that research mm-hmm. being talked about because there are now other things, other challenges have emerged. So, yeah, great to hear your history in that.
Yeah, thank you. It's and history that is still going.
Yes, absolutely. So I mentioned in my introduction that you were the first person to make me laugh out loud about research impact. And that occurred during an interview where actually Tamika was interviewing you for one of her early, I think it might have even been the first of her research impact summits.
I did have the pleasure of being the first interview posted on the first Research Impact Summit. Yeah. And I give kudos to Tamika for continuing to do those. It's such an important contribution to the sector.
Absolutely. Yeah. In my interview with her, we focused on that a lot. And also now with the Impact Ignite conference, actually bringing the community physically together as well as sharing those interviews online, which have been going for quite some time. Now, the thing that made me laugh was Tamika asked about your definition of research impact. And you shot back with, I don't really want to get into that definitional dystopia, which at the time, you know, when we were in that kind of, like, you mentioned the REF, Research Excellence Framework, and, you know, there were loads of academics who were going, what does that definition mean? And picking holes in it and kind of, does my thing fit? And it's kind of like, essentially the definition is an effect on anything outside of academia. So if you can park a bus on that anything,
that's right. Yep. Yes, Julie's definition is the provable effects, hopefully beneficial, of research beyond the academy, or she says in the real world.
Yeah.
It's a big definition, and anyone can find themselves in that.
Yeah, absolutely. It is not exclusionary.
Right.
So, but I'm really interested to know, in terms of, you know, when people are having questions, you know, chance to interview you or question you after a presentation, what's the question that really challenges you about impact? You know, it probably isn't the definitional side of things, but what's the thing that kind of go, do you know what, I really need a better answer to this?
I'll tell you what, there's one question. The first thing I'll talk about, though, is not a question. What makes me anxious is supporting mathematicians, their impact pathways. Mathematicians are so creative, but they're so esoteric to non-specialists, right? And but nonetheless, I use the same tools that I use for a social scientist or policy relevant research, you know, and I ask up front, you know, what are the potential uses? It might be 40 years out, but what are the potential uses? Not only exploring end users, but next users. Who could be the next users? Because often when you're that far out, you don't know what the end user is, but you might know who is next user. Mm-hmm. And who are the people? How do they want to be engaged? How will you know if you've made a difference? So I will say that I can get anxious when thinking about mathematicians. The question, though, that I find that I struggle with still is, how do we create a system that supports impact in resource-constrained environments? And we were talking about this, Jed, that, you know, the Canadian system, the UK system, are really struggling right now with financial challenges. And we've got no money in the Canadian system. And so it's hard to travel. It's hard to do professional development. And, you know, when we're thinking about these non-commercial pathways to impact, there's money in governments, but governments, at least in Canada, are funding only commercialization and industry partnerships. Mm. They're not, you know, we don't have policy engagement units. We're developing knowledge mobilization units supported through Research Impact Canada. But I would say that while we've got a large number of institutions in the membership, I feel that most of the jobs are still precarious. Mm. And that is changing a number of universities. But I think one thing that we need to be mindful of as we think about this, and it's the hardest to answer question, is how do we do this when we don't have any money? How do we do this work when there's expectations, especially REF expectations, expectations by REF, when there's not a lot of money in the system? And so I find that to be the most challenging question, is how do we find the resources that we desperately need when there's so much competition for those resources?
Yeah, that's a real nub of many issues in HE sectors across the world. You know, and both of ours are suffering at the moment. You know, we've both been in them long enough to have seen those ebbs and flows of when, you know, money is easier. I wouldn't say easy, but easier, and when it's harder. And this feels like the hardest time in my career. I don't know if
the same with me. Yeah, this is the first time where, as a sector, we've been fighting to have resources just to keep the insufficient number of staff we have.
Yeah. And what I know you haven't got you're challenged by that question, but what steps have you tried to take in terms of, you know, moving it along, moving the dial on it?
I guess there's two lenses: what's happening at the university and what's happening in the country. At the university, we're fortunate that we established our knowledge mobilization unit in 2006. We've had two people since 2007, and we've still got the same two people, which is delightful to have been working with colleagues for 19 and 20 years each. We haven't grown the office more than two people. But it's a small but mighty function, mighty office. And so all positions have had to be justified of late. So, but fortunately, and we'll talk about some of these motivations for the university later in our conversation, but the university recognizes the need for these functions. In Canada, how do we move the needle along? What we're starting to see is not just more universities and research organizations, but we're seeing funders, we're seeing health charities. We're seeing, we've got a couple of Research Impact Canada members who are doing work with veterans and families, right? So, so knowledge mobilization jobs are becoming more, we're seeing more of these jobs being posted, which I think that's that's the direct response to the advocacy that Research Impact Canada has been doing. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's just another job I saw posted this morning from Toronto Metropolitan University, hiring a knowledge mobilization and Research Impact Canada. Knowledge mobilization and Research Impact Manager is the position. So I think institutions, especially heartening in these resource constrained environments, that institutions nonetheless see the value of these positions.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you said, thank God we don't have a REF, but actually, to some extent, the case studies that came out of the 2014 REF definitely helped the university story in the UK. And I think we'd be in a worse position now than we are. We are in a bad position, but we'd be in an even worse one if we didn't have that data.
Do you know, the REF has been, when I say I'm happy we don't have a REF, I should say I'm happy we don't have your REF. the REF has been really, it's created our sector. It has created our jobs. Essentially, REF has put impact on the research ecosystem agenda, right? And so REF has also created those 7,000-ish case studies. Are incredible sources of scholarship and of research now. Like, we're learning more about research and impact because of those case studies. There's a lot of things. If I was to design a research impact assessment program, well, in fact, we do have in Canada, I would do it differently. And in Research Impact Canada, we have taken the REF impact case study and we've made adjustments to it to make it more Canadian-like and more democratizing knowledge, putting the voice of the partners and users into the case study, making it less university-centric. So there's things like that. And I wouldn't tie money to the exercise. Money is a great motivator, but it also drives unintended consequences.
Anyway,
we're starting to go down a rabbit hole that I don't think you and I need to go down.
That's right. Yeah. Now, so you mentioned it's quite some time that your university has had a knowledge mobilization unit. And actually, as I mentioned, lots of people have said, you know, when they were getting into the game and starting to go, where do I learn how to do this? Lots of their eyes went to Canada. And I kind of went, why is that? What is it about Canada? What is it that seems to be the secret sauce there that people are finding really valuable? So therefore, I kind of, you know, that's the next question, really. You know, what is it about the Canadian system? What is it about the things you're involved with and Research Impact Canada? You've mentioned that organization about. So tell me a little bit about, you know, what's the sector like? Why did it create this this wonderful resource that people have come and learned from?
Yeah, it's good. I'll weave in a bit of Research Impact Canada in there, but it's not just Research Impact Canada because we are not the be-all and end-all to impact in Canada. The motivations for impact in Canada are fundamentally different than in the UK because we don't have that assessment. And this is how Julie Bailey and I first started collaborating, because recognizing that because of the REF, that the UK thinks about impact as something that you need to describe. Right. And it's what has happened in Canada. We think of impact as something we want to make. So if the UK is a what country and Canada is a how country, you know, if you think of a Venn diagram, the third bubble of that is who are the people that do this work. So the intersection of knowing how to create impact, knowing what you must, what you can assess, and what are the skills of the people you need to do this at intersection, is research impact literacy. And that's how Julie and I first started our collaboration. We care about assessment in Canada, but we do assessment there's no money attached, it's not a REF. It's not so much about accountability, but it's more about what we call analysis, about learning. Mm. We assess impact to know if we've done a good job, and then to learn how to do that better. And that job is making impact. So you can't assessing and making impact and assessing impact are intimately connected, but we assess for impact because we want to learn how to do it better. Right, we're not doing impact to get more money out of a system. We're not trying to tell a better story to get more money. We're trying to make a better story. Period. Now, Research Impact Canada. As I said, I got to York in 2003. I was a tech transfer guy. There's a funding program in Canada at that time that was called the Intellectual Property Mobilization Program. And it was really funding money for VP's research, vice president's research, to build our capacity in tech transfer. It was just tech transfer. It started in 1995, and the fourth round was in 2005. And York University collaborated with the University of Victoria. Different parts of the country, both provincial capitals, neither had medical schools. Mm-hmm. And so we collaborated and we wrote to this tech transfer competition, nice, you want to fund tech transfer, we want to fund knowledge mobilization, please fund us. And they did. And so we started as York and UVic with this money from 2006 to 2009, with no small amount of hubris. We called ourselves Research Impact Canada. Having only two universities. So that money went to 2009. Both our universities picked up the salaries of the staff. 2010, we invited four institutions to become members of our two university network. Geographical coverage is important for all of our countries, but also French language capacity is important in Canada. So we invited a Quebec institution. 2012, we held an open call, got four new members. And so that took us up to 10, and we've just grown since then. we stayed as universities. It was a big decision. Do we open? Because universities are not the only research performing organizations, right? And so do we open up beyond universities? And it was a, we had to three very deep conversations over the years about this. Finally, in 2021, we welcomed Ontario Shores, which is a mental health research and practice hospital in Ontario. And that was our first non-university member. And we've grown from there. Now we've got a college, a technical college. We've got four hospitals. You've got some funders and some research user organizations. And it's really, Research Impact Canada now is really representative of the diversity of the research enterprise in Canada. And so our job is to, we are a member-driven community of practice. So we are driven by the needs of members. Our job is to share, create an environment where universities can share and learn about how better to do research impact and how to assess the impacts of research. And interestingly, because it's different than some of the other networks like UPenn and ARIS, UPenn in the UK, ARIS in the States, we are exclusively professional staff. Active in the network. We do not have the researchers who are wanting to do impact in their research. We're professional staff who then go back to our institutions to help that researcher who wants to do impact in their research. So by building capacity of professional staff, we build the capacity of the institution. So our members are institutional. I think that ARIS, Advancing Research Impact in Society in the States, has something like 1,200 members. We have 47, but they're all institutions. It's 46. We have 46, and they're all institutions who are paying a membership fee every year. That's unique amongst the networks. We are not externally funded. We're funded by our members. And so it's unique in that we build capacity professional staff who then come back to our institutions and then help our researchers and students and their partners.
Yeah, fantastic. And you have a couple of UK, is it a couple of UK members?
We got three. Yeah, three. We got Brighton and Bristol and LSBU, London South Bank.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And has that discussion kind of, that different slant from the UK sector kind of changed the conversations in any way?
So it has absolutely, what we in Canada have learned from the UK is learning about the REF, studying the REF, adapting what we wish to from the REF for our own purposes. That's been very valuable, and the UK members have been helpful putting some perspective on that. I'd say the motivation is twofold. Well, it's interesting. We did have a fourth university that I won't name, but that fourth university, when I said, okay, well, now we've got four universities, we could now have some impact work on your time zone because, it's always dinner time for our UK members yes. whenever we do yeah. anything at lunchtime in Canada. And the comment I got back was, well, we're here to learn what you do. We can talk to the UK members anytime we want. Right. So it's really the motivation for them is a more on the international engagement.
I mean, I think there's very much we've been doing some things for the Worldwide Universities Network, which Leeds is a member of. There's a number of UK universities as well as there is a Canadian, I think, and US and Africa, et cetera, et cetera. But that kind of made me realize that everything I kind of know about has that contextual lens, you know, that UK contextual lens. So when I was kind of like, can you do a session on impact? It was kind of like, well, how is that conceived elsewhere? Mm-hmm. How is that, you know, what elements does it feed into assessment? Does it feed into grants? How are the universities helping to achieve this? You know, what kind of structures do they have? You know, do they have people like me? Do they have people like you? You know, those sorts of questions kind of went, I actually don't know the answers to much of those.
And it's, you know, the around the world, you know, networks, academic research networks seeking to make an impact on X, on maternal health, on antimicrobial resistance. Those are everywhere. Networks like Research Impact Canada, like UPenn, like ARIS, there's not many of us where we're content agnostic. Right. We're and so it I've we've now got a global conversation amongst those networks. So there's UPenn in the UK, ERIS in the States, Research Impact Canada. Europe is represented by the Enlight group of universities. Yes. I think there's 11, maybe 13 of those. Vincula is a network of 22 Chilean universities. No money, and they but they've did this wonderful created a wonderful network all at the policy interface, so all working to do work with their Congress, their federal government. There's the Africa Research and Impact Network, and there's a group, there's a number of networks in Australia, but one that we're working with is the Australia Policy, oh God, forgive me, Anthony, I can't remember the whole Australian one. And then there's a network, IPEN is the Impact Policy and Evaluation Network of the seven Crown Research Institutes in New Zealand. You know, there's and all of very not, none of us except the UK have an impact, have a ref. Right. So the rest of us are coming together about how do we do this with our institutions? How do we do this with our researchers? But all the questions you raised, do you have an assessment system? What's your funding like? You know, and what kind of staff, what does staff makeup look like? Those are all different around the world. And it is interesting. It's one of the joys that I have is learning about how the Americans do it, how the UK do it, you know, and so this is what your podcast is also doing, is learning. You've had Tamika from Australia, you've got me from Canada, right? Getting these different perspectives.
Yeah. I mean, it's been fantastic to that, and I've got an episode coming out where I connected with an old colleague at a university we both used to work at, who's been in the Middle East for the last 15 years. So it was kind of like, tell me about that. You know, what's it like working there? What's research culture like? You know, and interestingly, you were saying, because we don't have a historic system, everything is designed rather than organically growing. So, but that feels quite, I don't think he'd be upset about this, but almost interventionist by the government. Yeah. Like, we want it to be like this.
I mean, Middle East, it's interesting that your colleague has been there for 15 years. Jonathan Grant moved to KAUST, the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, I think, which I think is Saudi Arabia. I'm not sure.
So, yeah.
Right. And so anywhere Jonathan goes, impact is going to follow.
Yes.
Right? And so it'll be interesting to watch his trajectory at KAUST and see where his input can help can do this work, because the Middle East is lots of tech transfer in the Middle East for sure. Yeah. But this more focus on non-commercial pathways to impact, is it'll be interesting to see where that comes.
Look out for that when it drops, if you're interested in that region and how it's developing. Now, you've been at York, as you said, since 2003, and the Knowledge Mobilization Unit came into being not long after that. So in that time, what's your assessment on how successfully research impact has been integrated into the research culture at the institution?
I think we rock. I'll tell you that. And it's not just because they pay my salary. I truly think that York University is among the leaders of this in Canada. And I'll tell you why. It's not just because of the Knowledge Mobilization Unit. We do a great job. But our current university academic plan, that is the top level plan for the university. It's got a section on research, as all of our plans do. But it's got, I wrote it down because I want to read it to you. As change accelerates around us, we aim to be more responsive to our communities by generating critical knowledge in works of art, ideas, and innovations that engage multiple perspectives while propelling Ontario as a global knowledge economy leader. That's a statement in our university academic plan. This responsive to communities is making an impact in society. Global knowledge economy leader is an impact on the economy. So we've got it in our university academic plan. We have in Canada, we have a tenure and promotion system, and our policy on tenure and promotion that describes the professional contributions, its enabling of artistic expressions, public scholarship, community-based research. So we've got an enabling policy. And it's also journal articles, if you want to hang your hat on there, as most of us do. So we have a policy. And I'll tell you what's just come up, and this is why it's a sustainable I see impact as being sustained as a goal of the university is we've got an integrated resource plan. It's how we report annually, each division, on the successes that we're making. And a new metric for research is research value stories. I can't tell you what that means because it was only it was only 3 weeks ago that I first saw these, and we're actively talking now. What does a research value story look like? It's going to be not as robust as an impact case study, but so the university truly, from the very top level planning documents down to the indicators of progress at the divisional levels, impact is there.
That's great. Yeah, that sounds like a fantastic way that it flows through the whole nature of the institution, all its branches and elements.
Can I just add also, because we do have, so that's what the university says is important. Now, how is it resourcing this? So we've got the Knowledge Mobilization Unit, which is amazing. We've got some funding for what we call Knowledge Mobilization Exchange Grants. So there's small $6,000 grants, and we make about 20 awards a year for seeding knowledge mobilization activities. And we've got the President's Research Impact Award. It's an award. It's part of a comprehensive suite of research awards. But the we just had the award ceremony a couple of weeks ago. Carrie Kawakami from the Faculty of Health. Her work is around identity and inequality. And her work's been cited in multiple cases by the U.S. Supreme Court. Right. And so she won. She was the winner of the President's Research Impact Award just a couple of weeks ago. So it's in our policies, and that's hugely important. So it's not just a marginal activity off someone's desk. It's being resourced and it's being recognized and rewarded. And I think those are the elements. That's what you need to make a robust impact culture at the university.
Yeah. I mean, Leeds is lucky enough in that many of the research councils provide us with essentially a little bit of block grant called Impact Acceleration Awards that enables those similar types of projects. But it's interesting that most of that is external money that is enabling that. I would wonder how much would be pulled together if they completely disappeared and it was left to the institution, because I'm assuming the money you were talking about there was institutional money being.
That's correct. Yeah, we've got external funds that support commercialization through Intellectual Property Ontario. We've got external funds that support entrepreneurship. Lots of money supporting entrepreneurship, and we have absolutely zero money supporting knowledge mobilization. External money. So it's work that we are doing. By the institution for the institution.
Yeah, fantastic. It's great to hear that, and I know we're getting towards the main part of your working day.
It's all good.
It's ramping up with the emails. I'm sure they all started flying in now that now that the day's started in Canada and early afternoon for me. So we'll start wrapping up now. This question is usually the hardest one for most people. Most people have gone, do I really have to just try and narrow it down? So people have kind of bent the rules a little bit over time, because I used to ask for just one name here.
That's tough.
Just to be kind to you, you're on my list of impact heroes. What I'd love to see this happening with this interview series is that I start interviewing people I don't know. And people I haven't come across. So that was the reason for kind of having this question. So it's in terms of who are your impact heroes now? So because people have negotiated with me, I'll allow you to go with three. But because you've collaborated with Julie so long, she cannot be one. and she wasn't allowed to name you, although she did talk about you quite a little bit.
and I've also name dropped her.
So yes, you have already.
The audience will know that Julie is my hero of heroes, but I'm not mentioning her here. I am not going to choose a Canadian because it'd be like asking someone to name their favorite child. Yeah, you know, and so I'm not gonna do it in Canada. Three. The first one, Susan Reno, the University of Missouri. She's my counterpart at the American Network, Advancing Research Impact in Society. She's doing amazing work. She's secured lots of external funds for this. She is also researching this work as well, and amazing work. She's creating training. She's building cultures of research impact in the very uncertain environment that the United States finds itself in today, right? So she's doing amazing work, and she's doing amazing work in that environment. So so kudos to you, Susan. I've also already mentioned Vincula from Chile. So my second impact hero is Francisca Reyes from Pontifical Universidad Católica de Chile. I think I pronounced that right. She created this wonderful network, Vincula, from scratch with no resources, 22 universities all engaging now with their federal Congress. So kudos to her. Just she's doing wonderful, wonderful work. Brand spanking new at this. Like, I think she put Vincula together in 2022 or 2023 and has already grown it to 22 members. So good to her. And my last one, Wade Kelly. He's at Deakin University in Australia. I'm going to say he's a writer to watch. We've been doing some writing together, and I am so impressed at how he says so much with so few words. I've just got a couple of things that I've read. He was doing a presentation to in Europe to EARMA, and I was watching it, and he said, impact isn't something researchers deliver. It is something that systems produce when they're resourced appropriately, i.e. we should not be looking at just researchers to produce impact, but the systems need to support that impact. But he says it in so few words. The second one, I just read it the other day, it's a question: is the institution accountable for the conditions of impact it generates, not only the impact that it claims? And this is talking about, you know, how institutions love to claim impact but not necessarily invest and support it. And so Wade has got this wonderful way of writing, saying so much with so few words. So Wade Kelly is my third impact hero.
Yeah, and you said you weren't going to pick a Canadian.
There's too many Canadians to choose from.
Yeah, he might be in Australia and been there quite a while now. But
right. He is Canadian. He is Canadian. Yes, sorry, you're right. He grew up in a small town outside of Edmonton.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I know that is because I've interviewed him as well. So I'll stick that.
Wonderful.
I'll stick that that episode link in the show notes too, if you want to hear a bit more from Wade with that amazing and very accurate summation of Wade's skills. He is amazing.
Yep. Very true.
David, thank you so much for your time today. You delivered on your goal for making me laugh.
Yes.
The thank God we don't have a ref I think that's kind of a therapy laugh, isn't it? It's kind of like, you know.
Yeah, best done in groups.
Yes, absolutely. And I'd personally like to thank you, actually, for all the work that I've read of yours over the years. Sometimes it feels like you're just reaching out and giving me the right answer, the answer I need right at that time. I think back to that when you did a lot more on Twitter, when it was a nice place. It was part of your banner, that lovely diagram. That was one of the amazing things. Yeah. I'll put a link to that paper in the show notes as well. So
the co-produced pathway to impact.
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, which absolutely wound up in quite a number of presentations around that time and training courses that I was doing.
Amazing.
So thank you so much for that. When I interviewed Vicky, she said, "You've used my papers," and I was like, "Yes, of course."
of course, Vicky. Yes, we have.
Yes. So thank you for all of those. Thank you for your for all that help, all those generous insights and guiding me on my journey in this complex and really intriguing landscape of research impact. It's fascinating. So can I ask you to say goodbye to our listeners and offer them whatever thoughts you want to wrap up with?
Oh, well, first off, thank you, Jed. This has been fun. It's been a great opportunity. Thank you to all the listeners. We don't do this without you, that's for sure. Last thoughts, pearls of wisdom, is find your network, find your community. There's a lot of us out here. Many of us are doing amazing work, but not shouting about it. And we're all here to help each other.
And it's a very generous network. If you're new to it, reach in, you will only find wonderful people.
Agreed. Thank you, Jed.
Thanks for listening to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. Please subscribe so you never miss out on our brand new episodes. And if you're enjoying the discussions, give us some love by dropping a 5-star rating and written review, as it helps other research culturists find us. And please share with a friend and show them how to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and here's to you and your research culture.